93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast, presented by 93X FM in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. I want to thank you for checking out this first episode, and I hope that what you're about to hear encourages you to keep listening to future installments. The point here is to enjoy ourselves. The name of this podcast is a reference to a Japandroids album, but it's also a literal description of what we'll be doing here. I love the rock continuum, the way that you can draw a straight line from a band like Japandroids to the Hold Steady, to Jawbreaker, to the Replacements, to Bruce Springsteen, and beyond. I want to celebrate that continuum on this podcast. I'll be interviewing up-and-coming bands as well as rock legends, punks, metalheads, indie kids, folkies, country singers, and all the rest. I'll also be talking with writers about emerging trends, as well as fellow fans about what they love and what they don't love about the records that they're listening to. The conversations will be celebratory as well as revelatory. I know that most people listen to podcasts in the car or at the gym, but in my mind, I'm imagining you all hanging out in this huge wood-paneled basement with lots of friends and a cooler full of beer. So without further ado, let's get started. My guests today are the singers for two of the biggest rock bands in the world right now, Matt Berninger of The National and Dan Auerbach of The Black Keys. I caught up with both of them in November when each was on tour with their respective side projects, Elvi for Berninger and The Arcs for Auerbach. Elvi is a project that Berninger started in the late aughts with his friend Brent Knopf of the indie group Menomina, though they didn't put out a record until 2015. That LP, Return to the Moon, is really great and quite different from what Berninger's work is like with The National. I spoke with Berninger about Elvi, as well as a variety of other topics, including jam bands, the art of maintaining a long career in rock music, and of course the new National album, which the band has already started working on. Matt was kind enough to invite me on his tour bus. He was kicking back, drinking a Miller High Life, and in really good spirits. Here's our conversation. Are you aware that there's the Dead show across the street tonight?
I was made aware of that. I didn't know when we rolled in, but yeah, that's pretty cool. Is Bob Weir over there and everybody? Is everybody?
Yeah, I think it's Weir. Yeah, it's like Weir. No Phil this time. I think it's like Weir and the two drummers. And John Mayer.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Yeah. Bob played with us in San Francisco and we've got this whole compilation of indie bands mostly doing all these Dead covers, and it's been a really fun thing. I didn't actually grow up a Dead fan, though, at all. I was more of like an art school sort of Smiths. Oh, thanks. REM, U2, Smith, Violent Femmes, you know, Ministry, all that kind of stuff. But on tour at the National, Scott and Brian just play the Dead constantly. So it became kind of worked into the fabric of the soundtrack of National tours all the time, and so it's been kind of a fun thing to do these covers and I did two, Peggy O and I can't remember what other one. Morning Dew. But yeah, it's funny. I don't think I'm gonna text Bob though tonight. He sounds like he's gonna be busy. Yeah.
I don't know if you had the same thing I did growing up. There was a thing where you almost weren't allowed to like the Grateful Dead for a long time if you were into like alternative music or something.
Yeah, polarizing. The Dead were polarizing, and I was on the other side of the pole, you know, in high school and stuff. And I even went to a Fish show. Brian and Scott took me to a Fish show, and the show was fun. I couldn't stand all the. I don't know, the strange hippie posturing from, you know, a bunch of smelly white rich kids and stuff, you know. So I had a chip on my shoulder against all that, like, pseudo-60s, you know, right. Stuff. And so I remember I went and waited in the car the whole time. It was like a six-hour show. I sat in the car.
Have you come around on Fish?
No, I mean, I actually worked on his record a tiny bit. I sang back up on one of his solo records. I'm kind of buried in the mix, but and he's played with the National, and that was all. I was on the other side of it in high school, but like, you know, being friends with Brian and Scott and hearing so much of that stuff on tour, it definitely grew on me.
Yeah, in the last 5 years, I've really come around on that band, and like I've seen him live a couple times, but saying you like Phish, it's still a little bit like saying you collect like precious moment figurines or something.
It's funny. It's like devotion to a band creates a sort of community, and it's fun to be in a community of people that love the same thing. It's like the way people get excited about a sports team, you know. It's like people just love, and it's mostly so like it's something they can talk with their friends about, and it's whatever, just safe territory to like. Sometimes fathers and sons or parents, you know, or people don't agree on politics or don't agree on this or that, but they can talk about the Grateful Dead or they can talk about the Cubs, you know, and that kind of thing. So, the National has those kind of fans that just like these communities of people that want to talk about the music and talk about the shows and record the shows and all that stuff. And it's an amazing thing. It's so lucky to have that kind of thing. I don't know. There's something. Music unites people in a really kind of interesting way. Yeah.
Yeah, and that experience you just described, that was exactly my experience with both the Dead and Phish, where when I got older, you don't have those sort of communal experiences as much as you do when you're younger, and I think that's why I gravitated to those groups.
Yeah.
Because there's such an active online presence, and you can seek out other people. This is the last show of the North American tour for Elvi.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure at this point performing these songs is as close to second nature as it's going to get. But at the beginning, was there any kind of weirdness for you as far as performing with a band that is not the National?
No. I mean, National wasn't the first band I was ever in. And Scott and I were in a different band in high school and stuff. It's just I've collaborated, on a few other things here and there. It's a similar feeling. I don't change that much. I do what I do, and I dive in, and I have a blast on stage. So it was the same way, with this. It hasn't been any kind of replacement of one or like escape from one to do the other. I just was curious to make songs with an old friend, which is exactly what the National is. We were old, friends first, and then we started making songs together. So it's similar.
I mean, I can see it being similar. I'm just wondering, like, I've never seen Elvi. I'll see them for the first time tonight.
It's a different kind of show for sure. And the music's, the chemistry of the music's very different. I mean, not 100% different, but it's noticeably different vibe, Elvi music and National music, and the show is a very noticeably different vibe too. It's just different. It's just different dancers dancing to different music. It's like it's different chemistry, and that's been really exciting. It's also, I think, all the National side projects, the things that people do, open up these windows, creative windows in our brains and stuff, and we bring all that stuff back to the National, and I think that all that really has helped the National sort of stay excited about being the National, and also just kept us sane. Working on this Elvi, I worked on it on tour with the National, like in a room. I mean, I'm actually working on stuff right now, National stuff and new Elvi stuff, like all the time, and I just open up different files that I'm excited about, and I don't have like a folder over here where it's like, here's the types of ideas that should be for the National, and here's the types of ideas that should be for Elvi. I don't do that. It's just I open up something and listen to the music, and I start singing along and coming up with stuff, and I kind of do the same thing. The music is very different, which leads me to do very different things, but I kind of don't. I personally don't see a huge separation between Elvi and the National.
Right.
And even like I'm doing other writing with my brother and my wife, and the documentary we made. My brother made this documentary, and I spent so much time working on that while on tour with the National, and that I feel is just like it's kind of this, it's all connected. These aren't separated projects so much to me.
Right.
It's all one project, kind of.
I mean, it reminds me, I talked to Justin Vernon this summer around the time of the Eau Claire's festival, and he, as you know, he's in a lot of different bands.
Yeah.
And for him, like, there's no...
for all those groups are on the same plane for him. Like, he doesn't differentiate between Bon Iver or Volcano Choir, even though the former sells way more records. And he really hates the term side project. He hates it when people call other groups that he's in side projects, because he thinks it's demeaning to those groups. Do you have a similar feeling on that?
I mean, it has to... I mean, you have to name it something. Other project. But even, but I don't. I mean, we've hesitated or not. You know, this doesn't feel to me, or at least when Brett and I were writing this record, we didn't feel like a band. We felt like a duo. You know, it was kind of this experimental duo that we were just having fun, like Hall & Oates or Pet Shop Boys or whatever those guys are. I mean, are they bands? I guess they are. But you know, I'm aware that, like, National is the big thing, and I've been doing it for 15 years, and this is the first time in 15 years that I've done anything significantly, you know, significant other than the movie. So I can see why people would call it a side project. It doesn't bother me. But I mean, again, I understand what Justin's coming from. For him, it's all part of the same network fabric of friends and musicians and artists that you like doing stuff with and hanging out with and making stuff with. So, I don't like Y-Oak and those guys, and like Andy who's playing drums with us, and there's just and the Nationals always have this big extended family of, whether it's Sufjan, Justin, Annie Clark, or Nico Muley, or Thomas Bartlett, or, you know, just so many different Sharon Van Etten, and there's so many different artists that we've just sort of like loved to collaborate with and make art with, basically. So for me, Elvi feels like it's just part of that whole big mix community of friends making stuff. Yeah,
I have to imagine though that there must have been something about Elvi doing this record that satisfied something in you that maybe you weren't doing in the National.
It has turned out to be something that I'm really excited by, that sounds different than the National, but it wasn't like I was in need of doing something. It wasn't so much in need of escaping the National's music or to do something that I wasn't getting out of the National's music. It was, if anything, it was just, Brent's a good pal, and I know, and I'm a fan of his music, and I was curious, but it wasn't like I needed it. It's kind of like, I'm completely, you know, totally satisfied, but it's kind of like having, you just can't resist having another dessert or something like that, or like, you know, a little, I wanted to try something else, but I wasn't like I was starving for anything more to do. I couldn't not, you know, put a new heaping of a different flavor on my plate. You know, it's just like I'm addicted to making stuff, and I love making stuff, you know. So I'm literally going back between Elvi songs and National songs that I'm writing all the time, you know. Sometimes and honestly, I'll be inside a song and I'll forget which is which when I'm writing, you know. It doesn't matter. I have to remember at the end, because I don't want to send the wrong one to the wrong to the wrong people. But so yeah, it's all like a big spider web of threads and ideas and ambitions. It's all part of the same web.
One of the threads on the Elvi record is the Minutemen.
Yeah,
talking about the Minutemen, what was it about that band that inspired you? You know,
it was honestly more of the documentary WeJ McConno than it was so specifically the Minutemen songs or records. Although Double Nickels on a Dime, one of the things, it just goes all over the place. It's got punk songs, jazz songs, acoustic guitar things. It's got, you know, it's just like there was Fearless experimenting, finding, just making noise in their basement so I love the fact that they're known as a punk band, but they did all kinds of stuff. They were just like fearless and reckless noisemakers, you know. And their friendship was based on, you know, just making this totally unnecessary thing, you know, rock music in the basement, and just expressing their frustrations with the Reagan year and all this kind of stuff. Just like, it was this outlet for these two misfit dudes to make a bunch of noise and feel less alone in the world and feel connected to something and connected to each other. And so that I was really inspired by that, how that they were bonded by this band, these two dudes, and I mean they were friends since they were little kids, I think too, and it made me just wonder and start thinking about when it was that like music became this fabric of part of my life that defined who I was and made me feel connected to a bigger community of other people that like the same kind of stuff, and that's just how you find your tribe and discover sort of your own identity, you know. And so a lot of the record's about that.
Yeah, the way Mike Wyatt talks about D. Boone in that movie, it's like, I don't know if I love my wife as much as Mike Wyatt loved D. Boone. It's
And they talk about how they would fight nonstop. He's like, we would fight, you know, they would fight all the time and stuff. And there was just, that was so great about it. There are these two young men who just like, just wanted to, you know, make songs about, in their, you know, the society. They're also, I loved that, like, they're punks, but they were like, they were so progressive, you know, politically awake and interested and engaged and even like they you know they have songs that are like Double Nickels on a Dime, and it's, you know, they thought it was, it's from the doc, but he's like, I guess it was the same time Van Halen or whatever, Sammy Hagar had I Can't Drive 55, and, you know, and trying to act like that's all bad, like speeding is like a badass cool punk, and they're like, No. Like they're driving the speed limit on the highway because that's not punk, you know. Speeding, that's just dumb, you know. And they were just like, punk is like knowing why Reagan's a piece of shit, you know, like and talking about it and making a song about it. That's punk, or that's badass, you know. Like that's rock and roll. And I just love that. I love that they kind of had a chip on their shoulder, but they were like really smart and passionate and had empathy for each other in the world. They're good guys, you know, and making this punk rock music or whatever they called it. So I think I like to work with people that I like to be around, you know, and it's not so much like looking for the you know, an incredible musical partner who's like, it's mostly just I want to make noise with friends, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like what, was there a band for you, like a singular, like record or band that made you say, okay, I'm a fan already, but I want to be in a band. I want to make music.
That's funny because I never really learned how to play guitar or piano or anything like that. So being in a band actually didn't even come close to entering my mind, I think, until I met Scott in college, and so that was later. But like. And at that time, I think it was, I mean, the bands that made me, that made me, like, it was the Smiths and then R.E.M., and then later it was Leonard Cohen and Tom Waits and Nick Cave, and then, you know, Pavement and Guided by Voices. But I think Guided by Voices and Pavement, those kind of bands were the ones that, when I was in college with Scott, that I was like, we should do this. And I think Bob Pollard lived 45 minutes north of where I lived, and just listening to those records made you realize, like, you can be pretty reckless with this thing. You don't have to have a fancy studio. The lo-fi thing that both those bands did was one of the big giant liberating things. I think so many bands are like, oh, you don't have to be able to get into Electric Ladyland or someplace.
And you can be 35 and be a school teacher
and still do it. Yeah. So I would say those two bands are the ones that suddenly made me that. And also, Afghan Whigs, he was from Cincinnati, and to think that like a dude from Cincinnati could be kind of a big rock star was like, I think maybe that's when I was, that was in my mind a lot, like Greg Dooley can do it, I can do it, you know. And yeah, those bands gave me a lot of confidence to not have to be that, I was about to say good, that's not the word, not have to be that polished or even, you know, you just have to be kind of fearless. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing, and sincere, and put your all into it, and be creative. You know, be whatever. And so, you didn't have to be that good at playing the guitar or that good of a singer, or any of that kind of thing. Yeah.
I know this wasn't intentional for the National, but you mentioned REM before, and the National is the only band that I can think of from the last 10 or 15 years that has had a career arc similar to REM's in the sense that you put out several records that each record was more successful than the last, and it wasn't until like maybe your fourth or fifth record that you became an arena band. And then, you know, bands usually don't progress like that anymore. I'm wondering, like, you know, being a music fan, do you ever think about the career arcs of bands that you've loved and thought about them in the context of the National? And like,
yeah,
like,
I mean,
like we want our eighth record to be like this band's eighth record or whatever.
I mean, our band would talk about REM, and we would talk about U2 in terms of models of, like, how do those guys manage to stay together? And Wilco is another one, you know, even though they kind of did fracture, you know, in different parts of Wilco, but ultimately, you know, Glenn, and a handful of them have been the core of that for, you know, after Jay left. But so there is a certain amount of just, like, Michael Stipe also is like, he said, remember, because we've the National had a lot of rough times of just interpersonal issues and stuff, and Michael Stipe would say, just remember that you guys were friends first. You had fun doing this because you were friends. That's how it started. Don't forget that. And that kind of stayed with all of us, I think, that like that just if it's getting bad or something, that it's getting too toxic, just get away from it for a while, you know, and just remind yourself, like, that it was, it's all coming from a place of you just want to make cool stuff with your pals, you know, so there's a lot of our we've thought of this band in perspective of wanting it to be a band that's meaningful and around and for a long time, and we have been, and so we've been very lucky that it worked.
Obviously the relationships in the band are important, but you also have this body of work that people love and that is important to a lot of people. Does that at all influence you as you move forward? I mean, I'm always intrigued by bands that stick around for a long time, because it seems like, you know, you spend the first part of your career trying to establish an identity, mm-hmm. that people know you by, and then you have this middle period where you have your identity, people yeah. love you, they come see you, and then it seems like it turns where either the public gets sick of that identity or the band gets sick of the identity, and then things uh-huh. get kind of weird.
Yeah.
And some bands can push through that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, well, is that something you think about at all?
Yeah. I mean, we're always... I mean, like, I know, like for example, like U2 or REM or, you know, or Wilco or Radiohead, they will... I think the reason why they lasted is because they would risk... They would take a lot of risks, okay? Now, the National... it took us a couple records just to find our footing, and then we did it. And we, every time we do a record, we're trying to sort of not repeat ourselves. At a certain point, there's a certain chemistry that you have, and it's you think you're reinventing the wheel when you're running, but it's still in the pocket of how that chemistry of five dudes, you know, sound when they make stuff together. So we've kind of, it's a weird thing of like keep wanting to push, you know, open up some windows and try new things and push, you know, challenge ourselves. But then when a great song that maybe it sounds like, it's like, yeah, that sounds like the National, but it's a good enough song, we're also like, that's a great song. We're not gonna like not do something with it because it's not, you know, we haven't reinvented the wheel with it, but sometimes a good song just is a good song. So, but I mean, I think it's important to risk failure, you know, and take, you know, just like it's. So I think Elvi was a fun way for me just to kind of. I never was worried about falling on my face, but I knew I could. Yeah. I never cared. I didn't care though. I think it's I love when artists. I mean, Bob Dylan has fallen on his face. You know, put out some of the. Neil Young has put out some terrible, terrible records. You know, I don't know if I'd say that to their faces, but like everybody knows that they've got a handful of records that are just dogs. You know, but I love the fact that they tried to, they kind of went out on these limbs. You know, and. I think that's why people are excited about them. That's why people are still excited about Radiohead, because you're not really sure what the hell it's going to sound like. Like, they might blow your mind again, you know? You never know.
And then you said you're working on National stuff here in the bus while you're on tour. And I saw that Stereo Gum story, and it seems like you guys are all pretty enthusiastic about the work you've done so far on the next record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's, I mean, a lot of that has been exaggerated. I mean, I say there are, and probably by me, but there's a lot of ideas that we've been floating around, and there are five, I can say with confidence, that I think might be five of the best national songs ever we've ever written. They might be, but I always get excited when the National starts writing a new record. You know, I always think that, you don't know. But I'm very, very, very pumped about a lot of the stuff we're doing. And even the one that we've played live, the only reason we picked that one is because it's like, okay, this doesn't sound like any of the other things that we've been doing. Let's just do this one because it's just this weird like little meditative loop thing that happens, and it's. I don't even know what we're calling it now. We've changed the name a couple of times. But anyways, it's all going awesome. There had been reports that we've got 30 amazing new songs. And it's like, we don't have 30 amazing new songs yet. But I can't say we got five that I'm just like, I'm in love with. Totally in love with, yeah.
And yeah, you mentioned like Fractious Times in the past. And I know that, you know, like when High Violet came out, there were stories that was a difficult record to make. And it seemed like Trouble Will Find Me was perhaps maybe a little bit easier in comparison. I mean, would you say that it's easier to communicate now maybe than it used to be, you know, creatively in the band?
Yeah. I think before, the thing that would cause problems is that I was always fighting about, the music. And I think sometimes you have an idea, you get excited about a song, you have an idea of, you know, a loose idea of the way the song wants to go, and it wants to be, but then someone else has a different idea, and so you hear a song that's not what you wanted it to do, and you get so terrified that the other person's never going to understand what you wanted it to be, and so you go in these corners, and you get so precious about little things, I mean, then like Aaron and I have had fights about tambourine parts, you know, big fights, and I think a while back we just stopped, like we're like, what are we fighting about tambourine parts? You know, like we fight about other stuff, but it's like we're learning that you can, like I think having kids and stuff puts it all in perspective. It's like, why are we getting so wrapped up and so totally like tied in these knots of ambition and. Power struggles and creative directions and stuff like that. This is a blast. Like we're having a blast. So there's no reason for us to be at each other's throats all the time. And so we've stopped doing it.
Is it fair to say that we probably won't see a national record till like 2017?
It'll be 2017. Yeah. Just because we're doing it in a process that is. Everybody just wants to enjoy it. We also want to play songs live a lot first before we record the record, which we've never done that. We've done that a couple times. Like Blood Buzz, we were playing versions of Blood Buzz a lot before we ever recorded that. But there aren't too many songs that we ever played live before we recorded them. But the ones we did ended up being some of our best stuff. And so we're like, let's play stuff live before we record it. And so you'll hear lots of bad versions of new stuff probably in 2016, but a studio record won't be until 2017. Yeah.
All right. Well, Matt, I think that's all of our time, so okay. I'll let you go. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, good to see you, man.
My next guest, Dan Auerbach, is currently busy with his own side project, The Arcs. I met up with him in the bar of his hotel just across the street from where The Arcs played the first date of their American tour a couple months back. Auerbach, of course, has had a lot of success with the Black Keys in the past 5 years, but lately he's put that band on the back burner in order to produce artists such as Lana Del Rey and Dr. John. Last fall, Auerbach put out his first record with the Arcs. It was called Yours Dreamily, and he's kept on putting out new Arc songs after that. I talked with Auerbach about his prolific work with the Arcs, his background as an introspective blues-loving teenager, and the future of the Black Keys. Here's our conversation.
The first Arcs record came out in September, which is obviously not that long ago, and I was just reading that you're already close to done on the second Arcs record.
I mean, theoretically, we have enough songs.
Yeah.
We have more than enough songs. We just need to sit down with them and sort of put them together like a puzzle, you know, puzzle piece.
I know there was like a huge backlog of material going into the first record. Yeah. Are we still talking about those songs or are there new songs?
No, these are all new songs. Yeah, all new songs.
And like, when did you even find time to get into the studio to do more songs?
Just whenever I'm home, you know, try to get in the studio whenever we're together. I mean, we can do 2-3 songs in a day, so, you know, just a couple days in the studio can be pretty fruitful sometimes.
And when you're doing that, I mean, do you already have songs in mind, or is it just a matter of getting together and jamming it out?
We just got to get together. That's all we need to do. And have somebody to press record. That's it. Well, we can do it ourselves. And, you know, it doesn't really matter. We're just like, you know, we just have this, we've always had this natural chemistry, this crew. And whenever we get together, it's just, it seems to happen really naturally, really easily.
Right. I mean, you're obviously on the road now. I mean, being a person who clearly loves to make records, is it hard to be away from the studio and on the road like this?
Yeah, it is. Because I definitely get kind of addicted to it, you know, and want to. I mean, I was in the studio the day before I left for tour. You know, of course, I got really close to finished on something, and now I have to wait a month to finish it. So that can be a little frustrating sometimes, but, you know, it is what it is.
Now, have you always been like that, or is it more of a recent thing now that you have your own studio?
Always been like that. Ever since I really kind of got kind of taken over by music, I've just tried to do it whenever I can.
Like, when did you first start recording yourself?
When I was like 14, yeah, 15.
And like, what was the inspiration to do that?
Just real practice, really. I mean, I was like learning how to play guitar, so I was recording myself playing and singing, and I was like learning how to sing and learning how to play guitar and sing at the same time, which was really, really hard when you're first starting. So recording was a way of kind of helping me learn, and then it sort of also became another passion.
I mean, like, were you inspired at all, like, by like other Ohio bands, like the lo-fi stuff that was going on at that time? Or
I was sort of in my own little world, kind of listening to lots of blues music when I first started playing guitar, but current blues music, stuff on Fat Possum Records, things that were actually happening in North Mississippi, like R.L. Burnside and T. Model Ford, and so I was kind of like really getting into that and learning how to play guitar, and so I wasn't really, no. So yeah, I guess the answer is no.
Yeah, I mean, like, have you always thought primarily in terms of records versus like live performance?
Like, what do you mean?
Like trying to make like a great record first before thinking about performing a song live.
They're two totally separate things, you know. And like, I treat them as two totally separate things. You know what I mean? I don't think about the stage when I'm in the studio, and when I'm on the stage, I don't really think about the studio.
I mean, was there a particular record for you that was sort of like a eureka moment, that like you heard it and you thought, this is what I want to do, I want to make something that sounds like this or makes me
no,
feel like this?
No, I mean, the first musical moment was my family playing music. They played bluegrass and they sang, so that's what I wanted to do. That was my eureka moment with music. That's what made me want to play guitar and sing.
As far as making records?
In terms of sonically?
Yeah.
I mean, things that really got my attention when I was younger were more like hip-hop. Like, first the music I ever bought was the Geto Boys, My Mind Is Playing Tricks on Me, the cassette single. And that was an Isley Brothers sample that they used for the guitar. I didn't know that at the time. But, so like, you know, sonically, that was one of the first things that really, like, made me happy inside. Do you know what I mean? Being at the middle school dance and hearing that song come on the speakers was like, always sounded great and it hyped everybody up, and I didn't know why. So, but that was one of my first musical kind of moments where that kind of grabbed me, made me go to the record shop.
I mean, at that time, did you feel like there was a connection between the blues stuff you were listening to and also the hip hop stuff? Like, was there sort of a shared quality to that you feel like you gravitated to?
No, it was like hip hop before. It was all kind of intermixed, really. It wasn't just, I mean, I was listening to, like, the Beatles, I was listening to the Kinks, I was listening to the Allman Brothers, and then blues music was constantly being played, and soul music, and Cab Calloway, and then, like, you know, the Wild at Heart soundtrack, the Dave Lynch film, you know, was constantly being played, which had some really cool shit on it.
Chris Isaacs.
Great Chris Isaacs songs. Blue Spanish Sky, which I love that song. Is that Blue Spanish Sky? Is that what it is?
I only know Wicked Game off of the Wild Eye.
You should check out that other song too. The whole first record has some really amazing stuff on it. But I mean, just constantly hearing music, you know, and then being with my friends, hearing Beastie Boys and early hip hop. I just love that stuff. I didn't really think about it in terms of like how it was connected. I either liked it or I didn't. And I think that's pretty much my criteria now for music, is I don't really think about what style of music it is. Right. I either like it or I don't. Right. You know, there's shitty music in every genre. You know.
When did you first start deconstructing records or thinking about them in terms of how they were made?
When I first started a multi-track record, when I got my first multi-track cassette recorder.
When was that?
I was 16, 17, and. Just once you start realizing that you're multi-tracking, you understand what that is, and you hear how terrible your recordings sound, you naturally start to wonder, how the fuck did they make things sound so good on these records that you love? And then that fascination just can kind of be never-ending, really, because it's just never-ending art form, really. I mean, anytime you go in a studio, something new can happen. And it's that kind of, that unknown, that excitement that can happen from the creative process that really can be so addictive.
You know, a lot of times when we talk about, people in the studio, we talk about things like Brian Wilson or Phil Spector, these sort of grand productions. But with you, it seems like you've always been after a grittier, rawer sound, a sound that seems like it's live, but in a way has been layered and sculpted. And you're trying to capture something that's there, but it takes a lot more painstaking work than it might appear.
Every project is different. Every project calls for something different. Sometimes it needs the big treatment. Sometimes it needs totally left alone. You know, and I think it part of the art of production is knowing when to do, knowing what direction to go, kind of go in. You know?
I mean, looking at the arc of your career, there's definitely been an evolution from early Black Keys records, which are so raw, recorded in basements, and where the aesthetic is almost where there's no aesthetic, to the records you've done lately, which again are very layered, have almost a hip hop sensibility in terms of layering sounds, having a strong groove, being very song oriented. Is that a matter of you getting better at what you're doing, or have your tastes changed over time and the kinds of records you want to make change?
I think I think that, the early Black Keys recordings were 20 years ago.
Right.
I mean, I would be really bummed out if I sounded exactly the same 20 years on, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, people's tastes change. But my core, I sound like a politician, my core values remain. You know what I mean? The groove has got to be heavy. It's got to be raw. There's got to be some real emotion. No matter what kind of musical genre it is, you know?
Right.
So, that's always been my goal.
What do you feel like you're better at, though, now than when you started? Is there anything specific that you pinpoint?
I don't know. Honestly, it's hard to say because, just the job changes every day. It's just so... the more you learn, the less you know, kind of thing. I mean, sometimes it's like that, you know? I mean, you're really trying to bottle magic, you know? And sometimes the magic is the naive bit, you know? The untrained ear is sometimes the ear that is going to best serve the music, you know? So it really keeps you on your toes when you think about it like that, I think, you know?
Yeah.
I really do love outsider art, art brute, untrained artists, you know what I mean? That's my favorite kind of art. It's my favorite. It tends to be my favorite kind of music. So I always have to keep my mind on that when I'm, not to get too fucking fancy.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean that.
Because I can do all that fancy bullshit, just like whoever, you know, but I choose not to, you know?
Yeah.
I can make records that sound like number one pop records. I choose not to, sonically. I want it to have I want it to be kind of hard to define when it's from, you know? I like it to sound like there's old parts, but then there's also very new portions. I want it to fool the ears, you know?
Right. Well, I was going to say that, I mean, you know, the Black Keys, one of the biggest bands in the last 5 years. I think one of the things that set your band apart is that you're one of the only bands that's been able to sort of effectively engage, like, a pop audience. And yeah. make records that can be played on the radio. It seems like a lot of bands either aren't capable of that or aren't interested in it. Mm-hmm. And I guess there is a question in here. I'm just sort of rambling, but like, I mean, do you see that as a problem in rock music? That like a lot of bands that bands don't seem to be interested in that or able to do that.
I think it's not that bands aren't interested; they're not able to do it. But I think that. At a certain point in time, I think it became uncool to be popular, to be mainstream popular, which is kind of a shame because, you know, I love the Brill Building aesthetic of Brian Wilson and Phil Spector. I love how it was a team of craftsmen working on a product that was always really raw, you know, and if you had the right producer, it could work, you know. So I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, look at the music industry, though. It's in the shitter. So,
yeah.
I think that may have that whole thing may have backfired a little bit.
I mean, you don't seem like a very self-conscious person in terms of the art that you make, and you guys are going to do what you want to do. But I mean, have you thought about it in terms of like, you know, like what you've done with the Black Keys, and of course now with the Arcs? Do you think of it ever in terms of like waving the flag for rock in like a more kind of mainstream context? Like, do you ever think about like, well, we need to be there because there will not be a band there if we're not there to do it?
I mean, I don't, not really. I don't think about that. I don't want to be in charge of anybody's thing. I want to do my own thing. You know what I mean? It's like stay in my own little bubble. And if it's success, then just like the Black Keys, it'll be an absolute surprise to everyone, including me. You know what I mean? Because honestly, I've only ever really done what I love. I haven't had a real job since I was 16, you know? And that was at a fucking record shop. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I'm really dedicating my life to like kind of just really sticking to my guns about my music. And I don't know that thinking about that is going to help. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, you know, with now that this is the first date of your U.S. tour with the Arcs, and you're going to be playing a club across the street, First Avenue. You know, after playing arenas with the Black Keys for so long now, is there something refreshing about playing clubs like this, playing to smaller audiences?
No, not really. I mean, it's not really about the size of the room. I mean, I've always said, like, with the Black Keys, like, people are like, don't you miss the small places? I'm like, no. I mean, we played enough small places that sucked to realize it's really not about the size of the venue, you know? It's the motion of the ocean. It's the audience. If the energy is there, then it's like, it doesn't matter what size room you're in. You know, we've played in front of, like, 60,000 people who were not interested. You know?
Yeah.
We played in front of 150 people that were going fucking apeshit. We played in front of 150 people who were not interested. You know? It's equally as a bummer. So, it's really about the moment. And that's kind of what's fun about music, too. Whether in the studio or on the stage, you really never know what it's going to be like. When you step foot on stage, when you step foot in studio, you have no idea how it's going to go. It could be terrible, it could be great, so... But it's putting yourself out there that is, like, half the battle.
Yeah, you were talking before about how much, you know, you love outsider art and raw, and art that is sort of primal and unselfconscious. You know, now that you're in this position, like you said, you've been doing, you know, you've been in bands now for 20 years. You've established a really successful career. I mean, how conscious do you have to be about retaining that kind of primal part of what you do?
I think it would be really easy to kind of lose focus. I mean, I see it with a lot of people. You kind of start to accept things that 15 years ago you would not accept.
Like what?
You know, living in LA. Becoming part of the big machine.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Sort of becoming a musical politician.
Right. And you're just in that
it's
bubble.
Like, hey man, you used to kind of have more of an opinion about things. You seem to be like really like cool with everything now. And you got a really comfortable job. It's like, that's what I mean. I think that when you stick to your guns, it can be a little, it can definitely be difficult, you know, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, when you reach a certain level of success, is there pressure to maintain, like, that level of success? Like, keep the machinery
going? I mean, we had my career has been weird because, like, we had really big success, but it wasn't until like our sixth record or something.
Right.
You know, so we'd been playing at a certain. I mean, every year was better than the last. You know, I mean that's how it was going with the Black Keys. So it's like it's hard to know like what the goal is, other than just enjoying yourself and playing music. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't think that I ever really put any pressure on myself to be like mainstream successful. I only put pressure on myself to make a good product. That was it. Make a good record, you know, because I like records. And if I was working on making like a catchy rock and roll record, that's what my focus would be on. And I would really try to do it. It would be like a goal. Just like, you know, just like whoever makes a catchy rock and roll, this just like they did, you know? Focus really hard on making it catchy.
Right.
You know, John Fogerty, Tom Petty, whoever, you know? They're really trying hard to make hits. They're not just in the studio, like, making art.
Right. Well, when you made El Camino, it seemed like that. It seemed like a conscious attempt to make catchy rock songs.
Yeah, we were definitely trying to write simple, catchy songs and use, like, the kind of basic instruments.
Right.
Not try to be too flashy with the studio production. Have it be really simple and, you know, we were kind of going for a simple, you know, it was catchy, but a lot of simplicity, I guess. That was the goal.
And then you do Turn Blue, which starts off with a 7-minute epic track, long guitar solo, and it's like, okay, we're not going to make a record like that necessarily this time.
Yeah, I mean, we've only ever made records that we want to make.
Yeah.
And we never talk about them ahead of time. They just happen. I mean, those are the projects that I work on. Even when I'm producing a record, people will send me demos, but I know, like, it's not really going to affect how it turns out if you send me your demo or not. I don't need to hear the song ahead of time. Because when we get in the studio, everything changes. And it's all about the magic of that moment.
So when you're at home, are you in
this
studio?
This magic moment. Huh?
When you're in the studio, are you like in the studio every day? When you're at home?
Yeah. Sure.
Like working on someone else's record, working on your own records?
Yeah. Pretty much one of those two.
And I walk me through that. Like, if you don't have anything specific that you're working on, is it just a matter of, like, you pick up a guitar, you pick up a drum machine?
Yeah, like, well, I mean, I'll kind of, like, yeah, I'll do whatever. I mean, sometimes the guitar is just the last thing that I pick up, you know? It's like, can start a song on a drum machine, yeah, like a bass, a keyboard, or whatever.
One thing I really want to ask you about, I'm intrigued by, you know, you have those upcoming Record Store Day releases coming out, and I know you've been writing with David Berman for a long time,
mm-hmm.
a couple years. Like, how did that come about?
I met him through my friend Harmony, who lives in Nashville, Tennessee, and David lives there. And Harmony's been friends with David for a long time. And, you know, we just hit it off and we started writing together, you know. And when I was out of town, we would do a lot of emailing back and forth, song ideas and stuff. And, and, you know, I guess I put a few of his songs to music but never released anything until that song on The Inventors.
And what was he like to collaborate with? I mean, he seems like a pretty singular character.
He is, he's amazing. I mean, it's really a joy for me. I don't know how to describe it. He's just, I mean, he's his sense of songwriting and poetry is really classic in like a country music kind of way. But he has such a sense of humor and such a dry wit that it's just so much fun. Because, I mean, he just always surprises me with stuff he says, you know. Yeah, it's been really fun.
I mean, do you know,
and he pushes, you know, he's definitely pushing me.
Right.
To expand my mind.
I mean, do you know, is he interested in making his own records? Has he talked at all about that?
We haven't spoken about that. We just talk about songs.
You know, like with all these, you know, different things that you're involved with, you know, like I recently interviewed Matt Berninger of The National. He's on tour with the band, Alibi. We were talking about sort of the idea of side projects and how that can be sort of a weird term, you know, to prioritize what you're doing. Mm-hmm. What's it like for you? I mean, obviously, you know, your guy is recording all the time. Like, do you prioritize? Like, is Black Keys still your main priority? Or is it just like...
Whatever I'm working on is the main priority. Yeah. I don't have side projects. Nothing for me has ever been a side project. Except for maybe, like, college. You know?
Right.
In music, everything is my main project. And whatever I'm working on gets my attention 110%. I don't fucking, like, put my name on the records as producer and not fucking be there. I'm there. I'm the first one at the studio. I'm the last one at the studio. I'm there during mixing. I'm overseeing mastering. I'm, like, helping with artwork if they need it. You know, whatever. Like, I really, you know, put everything I have into whatever I'm working on. And it's the same with the arcs. Right now I'm like focused on, we're just like enjoying it and having fun and like playing great shows. And you know, it's been really cool because we've been such it's been such a regular thing for us to get together in the studio, but this playing live thing is totally new for us.
Yeah.
After years of playing together, this is new. We're doing something really new. So it's been fun kind of experiencing this with these guys.
And I know you're in the Artist Zone right now, but have you thought at all about the next Black Keys record? Do you have any idea when that might happen?
No, not really. I haven't thought about it much. We just finished the tour not too long ago.
And Patrick's involved in his own stuff too, so he's going to maybe kind of do your own things for a while?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have. So
all right.
Thanks
great.
Again, man. I appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks so much.
All right, take care.
All right, that was Dan Auerbach. That was a great conversation. I'm really glad he was able to do that. Also, it was great to talk to Matt Berninger. That's our first episode. I hope you really liked it. If you did like it, we actually have another episode up already. I had a great conversation with Chuck Klosterman. So you can listen to that right after this one. Otherwise, we will be back next week. This is the Celebration Rock Podcast. I'm Steve Hyden. Thanks for listening.